We're starting the presentations once again. The 4 o'clock here, first presenter for the afternoon in this room, David Kaiser. He's a published author, wrote Epic Season, the 1948 American League pennant race. Many of you know as a frequent contributor to the Sabre L discussion boards. So without further ado, Mr. Kaiser, take it away.
Thank you very much. Since the beginning of baseball, there's been a lot of talk about what the most important part of the game is. Connie Mack claimed that pitching was 75% of the game. I was reading The Man in the Dugout, and I believe Eddie Sawyer estimated it was 80%. Jerry Francona said in his book, pitching is how you win. This presentation is designed to look at what really is most important to team success by looking at dynasties from baseball history from 1901 to 2015. So the first thing we have to do is define a dynasty. And this analysis, as you'll see, is based on run differential, and that's why I've worked this into the model. In at least 3 out of 6 seasons, to be considered a dynasty, you either have to reach the postseason or lead the league in run differential, that is, in Pythagorean percentage, without reaching the postseason, which does have happen from time to time. That is, in at least 3 out of 6 seasons. Performance in postseason play is determined more than anything else by luck, so it isn't considered in this study. And I can assure you that your favorite great team from the past is not going to be left out. So, what are the critical questions I was trying to answer? First, what part of the game is most important to create and sustain a dynasty? Hitting, fielding, or pitching? Has this changed over time and how? And a related question that comes up, as you'll see, is how has the distribution of talent among teams changed over time? And we'll be looking at teams by eras. Now, this is an outgrowth of a book which I've just signed a contract for with McFarlane, and which is already a little bit written, which is tentatively entitled Wins Above Average, How Great Baseball Players Made Great Teams, 1901 to 2015. And the point of that book is to determine what players specifically contributed to the success of pennant-winning teams and how much using the metric wins above average. And as I say, this study is at the macro level, looking at the overall performance of teams at bat, in the field, on the mound, but it's based on the same data sets which I've spent a couple of years developing. Now, good heavens. A slide seems to have disappeared. All right. I want to explain the methods, which we'll have to do without a slide. The contribution of the hitters is easy to determine with the help of the Pythagorean formula. You just have to park adjust the number of runs scored by the offense, subtract the average number of runs scored by an offense. That gives you a number of runs above average for that team, and it's easy to convert it into games, although the number of runs equal to a game differs from era to era. So, that was for the hitting. For the fielding, I used defensive regression analysis developed by Michael Humphreys in his outstanding book, Wizardry, which I can't recommend too highly. And all Michael's data on every individual fielder was put on spreadsheets and made available by the Oxford University Press on their website, so you can download them. And Michael's study is based on regression analysis, taking balls in play against a given team, then correcting for ground ball tendencies and also for right and left-handedness of pitchers. And he gets a number of runs saved for or allowed above or below average for every player in every year. Now, I was able to aggregate the data and turn it into team data so that I could say, for instance, as he did, the 1973 Baltimore Orioles, who were probably the best fielding team of all time, saved the Orioles about 10 games. Now, for pitching, I took the number for fielding, how many games the fielder saved, and subtracted it from the differential for runs allowed. In other words, what was left belonged to the pitchers. That does mean that the noise in the data is left with the pitchers, but Michael Humphreys actually has been doing more sophisticated analysis, putting pitchers into the model too, and the results he's gotten from that do not differ significantly from the ones from the pure fielding study which I used. So now we're going to start looking at dynasties. I do not understand what happened here, but I lost two whole slides. Sorry about that. All right, got to think on your feet. Let me make something clear. I split the history of baseball for this study into three eras, and it depends on how hard it is to get to the postseason. So first we have 1901 to 68, which we have here, where you have only two teams getting to postseason. Then 1969 to 93, where you have four teams in postseason. And then from 1995 onwards, where we have, eight or ten teams in postseason. So here we are with the first set of dynasties from the American League from 1901 to 1968, dominated, of course, by very long Yankee dynasties. And as you can see, let's just take that first column, those 1907 to 1909 Tigers. Their fielders, on the average for those 3 years, gave up one extra game. Their hitters were 12 games better than average. That was the strength of the team. I then added the batting and the fielding. Now, why am I adding the batting and the fielding instead of adding the fielding and the pitching? The reason is that the batting and fielding games are contributed by the same set of players, namely the ones who go out in the field and are in the lineup. The pitchers basically only contribute what they do on the mound. Their other contributions are highly marginal. So we see the Tigers' pitchers were five games better than average. But the main thing we see in this table, as we're going to see in every table, more or less, is that the bulk of the superiority of these teams that dominated their leagues in this era comes from their hitting, slightly from their fielding. The pitching is usually in third place. Now, again, here we have one team, the White Sox in 1915 to 19, and you're probably wondering about those dates. Actually, those White Sox were very interesting. They won the pennant in 1917 and 19, but they had the best run differential. I believe it was in both 1915 and 1916, so that's why they are in there. And they did have a pitching staff which contributed a little more than half of their wins above average. In the last three columns, by the way, those are the averages for the dynastic years of the team for one loss percentage. When we get to the great Yankee teams, we see hitting dominated even more. It seems to me, and I'll get this on the mat right now, there are two reasons why pitching is so overemphasized. One is a lot of dynasties come from pitchers' parks, like Yankee Stadium. More importantly, we have the stat that we give a win to a pitcher for every game that's won. And people don't think about it, but it's rather obvious. If you are an average or slightly above average pitcher who's durable, who can start every fourth day or even every fifth day, and you have a vastly superior offense behind you, you're going to have a very good record. But most of that record will not be due to you. It will be due to your teammates. So let's go on. And here we have the hardest one to read because it's the densest, the National League, for the same period. And again, we see three brief dynasties, relatively brief dynasties. The Giants, 1911 to 13, that's Mathewson and Marquard, and that's the most striking figure. The Cubs, who won three pennants in those years and also had a winning run differential in one other year. And lastly, the Cardinals, and some of that is from the wartime, but not all of it. And the Cardinals did lead the Dodgers in run differential in 1947. Whose pitching provided more wins than their hitting and fielding combined. But that is quite exceptional. Let me just mention a couple of the other dynasties here. The overlapping ones of the Dodgers from 47 to 56, and actually the Dodgers had the best run differential every year from 49 through 53, although they managed to lose two pennants on the final day, and the Braves that overlapped with and followed them. We don't think of the Dodgers as having a great pitching staff, and in fact, they had a perfectly average one. We do think of that Braves team as having a great pitching staff, but again, that's vastly exaggerated. Lou Burdett, in particular, at that stage of his career, was really quite a mediocre pitcher. And even the Koufax Drysdale Dodgers, their pitching was essentially equal to their hitting plus fielding. Their fielding was very good. Willie Davis was a big part of that. And actually, in one of those years, in 1966, the Dodger pitchers did provide most of their edge. But still, the pattern is very similar. And now we go ahead to the next era, and we have some very surprising and striking results. I just want to focus on three dynasties here, those Orioles and A's at the top, and then the Yankees in the late 80s. And as you can see, all of their pitchers were only slightly superior. In the case of Oakland, only marginally superior. It was done mostly by their hitting and to a large extent with their fielding. The Orioles in particular had tremendous fielding in those years. And again, the Orioles had the best run differential in 1975, too. Red Sox were quite lucky that year. The Yankees also show excellent fielding, and this is one of the most interesting things that has come out of my work. Billy Martin evidently totally understood fielding and would not keep a bad fielder in his lineup. You remember how, beginning with the Twins in 1969, he took over four teams, Twins, Tigers, Rangers, Yankees, and immediately turned them around, and then later did that with the Oakland Athletics. As I'll show in the book, an enormous amount of that had to do with fielding. Those were generally very poor fielding teams who, under him, became very good ones. Now, we have two brief dynasties, the Red Sox in the late 1980s, who only barely qualify as a dynasty, and whose value was almost all on the mound in the net, and more than half of that was from Roger Clemens, and the Blue Jays, but those are the only ones for whom pitching was more important than hitting. Meanwhile, in the National League, the picture is even more striking. Nobody among these dynasties depended mainly on their pitching. The great Pittsburgh and Cincinnati teams in the 1970s are very much dominated by their hitting. No surprise there. The Dodgers, who actually had a tremendous team in those years and were quite unlucky in postseason, did have a stronger pitching staff, but still the hitting was more important. And the same is true of those other two. In fact, this is the lowest contribution made by pitching in any of these graphs. So now we go to the third era, where it gets really easy to get in the postseason, or a lot easier. And we see something a little different. You may have noticed by now, when a team gets most of its contribution from pitching, the name of the team is italicized at the far left. So we have the Red Sox, thanks largely to Roger Clemens in the late 90s. Not a particularly good dynasty, averaging only 91 wins a year in the years that they were in the playoffs. I'm sorry, not Clemens. Pedro Martinez was responsible for most of those. We have those Oakland A's, the Moneyball Oakland A's. And a lot of people, a lot of sophisticated viewers of Moneyball, the movie, complained that they didn't pay any attention to the pitching staff, and they were absolutely right to complain. And then more recently, both Texas and the Tigers have done very well out of their pitching. And then we go to the National League in this period, and here we have the great exception to the rule, the most remarkable dynasty of all time in this analysis, the very first one, the Atlanta Braves, who were in postseason, I believe, 14 seasons in a row, and whose pitchers totally dominated all the way. We're going to look at them in more detail in just a minute. At the Arizona Diamondbacks for those 3 years with Schilling and Johnson show a similar pattern. And Schilling and Johnson were what Spahn and Sane were supposed to be in 1948 for the Braves, but weren't. That was one of the closest things to a two-man team ever in terms of who actually did the winning. And lastly, the Phillies, from 2007 to 2011, and we're going to look at them for a moment, in a moment in more detail too, one of those teams, their pitching contributed most of their edge. But for the most part, the hitting with some assist from the fielding, but not a great deal in most cases, continues to prevail. Now, here we're looking at averages by era and league. Which again confirms the overall pattern, but I want you to look at those last three columns, one loss and percentage, because you see what's happening to baseball. Remember, we're looking at the dynasties, the cream of the crop. But being a dynasty ain't what it used to be. Now, instead of averaging 98 games a year over those first two-thirds of the century in the American League, they're averaging 95. And remember, it's actually more of a drop than that, because for most of that 1901 to 68 period, that was 98 out of 155, not 98 out of 162. The percentage drop shows that. It's from 638 down to 596. And the National League isn't quite as big, but that's because the National League dynasties weren't as dominant. And now that's fallen still further in our own time. And, okay, we're going to come back to that in a minute. But first, let's look at a couple of specific instances. First of all, here is the data on every individual year of that Braves staff. And in particular, that period from 1933 to 1999, looking under the P game columns, the pitcher games, nobody has ever done anything remotely like that. It's been described as the Mazzoni effect. A lot of it is due to two Hall of Famers, Maddox and Glavin, with some assist from Smoltz, but it's a very remarkable record because baseball has literally never seen anything like it. And this one I had to mention because it jumped out at me. That 2011 Phillies team had one of the three or four greatest pitching staffs of all time. 19 games over 500 is extremely rare. And they did win 102 games, which is a lot, but they were eliminated in the first round of the playoffs, I believe by Milwaukee. So we're going to go back to that slide again for me just to take 1 minute to make an overall point about what's happened to baseball, which I think is rather sad. We don't see such dominant teams anymore. And I think there are two reasons for that. One reason is going to be a major conclusion of the book, which is that there's unequivocal evidence that in about the last 10 years in particular, the number of superstars on a per team per league basis has dropped a lot. It was extremely consistent at about 0.8 superstars per team per league for most of the history of Major League Baseball, and now it is well under that. So your chances of putting two or three of them together are very slim. And the second reason is it's just not worth it to you to spend the money that it would take to put together a team that would consistently win over 100 games when there's an excellent chance that you're not going to make the World Series anyway. And I think that's a lot of what we're seeing here. I think this is unfortunate for baseball. I don't think in the long run it attracts as much fan interest. I think dynasties are good for the game. As to the other bottom line, why is it that hitting tends to dominate more than pitching? That, too, was pretty clear from my research. Great pitchers don't stay great for very long. Since the beginning of time, the most common story in baseball is a young pitcher coming to the majors and throwing as hard as he can until he throws his arm out within 2 or 3 years. Now, again, that means he goes from 4 or 5 wins about average to 1 or 2. And if he's playing for a good team, he may pitch for a long, long time at 1 or 2 wins above average and win over 200 games and get into the Hall of Fame. But he's not allowing that team to win the pennant, as pitching staffs usually do not allow their teams to win the pennant. So those are my conclusions, and I'll be delighted to take any questions about your favorite team from the past or anything else. Thank you.
I'm sort of curious on your conclusion with regard to the Atlanta Braves. It seems to me that it might go some way to explaining why it is that a team with Maddox and Glavin and Smoltz that was so great had such a difficult time in the postseason, and particularly even in the early years when they won just the one World Series between 1991 and the year 2000. When you consider basically how poor their hitting seems to be according to the graphic you displayed.
Well, this study is giving me a healthy respect for the power of luck in baseball. And I think we chronically underestimate it and try to explain things that are just due to chance. And I think the Braves certainly were very unlucky in postseason. Now, there's one other thing I want to mention in a second, which is very interesting. In fact, the era of the 1990s and early 00s had more dominant pitchers who sustained dominance over a long period than any era in the history of baseball. It's not what we thought at the time because we were dazzled by the numbers, but in fact, it's the pitchers who were more exceptional in that era. But in theory, and according to the work Bill James did many years ago, analyzing who wins the World Series, dominant pitching ought to help you in the postseason. But you're right, it didn't help them enough. I suppose one possibility you could throw out, well, no, that wouldn't help because they usually didn't make it to the World Series. I doubt that, I'm inclined to believe the main explanation is chance.
I have just one question on methodology,
sure.
If you don't mind. You used wins above average as
opposed
to wins above replacement.
That's right.
Could you explain the difference between the two and why you chose advantage over replacement?
The reason, I think everybody knows what wins above replacement is. There are two reasons why I choose it. One is I think it's more accurate. We know what the average performance in the league is. The question of what the value of a replacement player is an estimate. But the more important reason is that if I can say that Mike Trout last year was 6 wins above average, which he was, as he has been in every year he's played, very similar to Henry Aaron, that means that because the A's had Mike Trout instead of an average player at his position, they won 6 games over 500. And that's a very useful thing to know. And you can't do that as easily with WAR. Okay. Yes. Yes. Yes, the fielding variance does definitely appear to be dropping across teams. That is true, although it still can be significant. But it peaked, interestingly enough, back in the 70s, which I do think was probably the most athletic era in the history of baseball, largely because of AstroTurf. And that could be the reason why it peaked then. Yeah.
Could you explain why you think that dynasties are good for baseball? And I'm thinking of the 1950s Yankees.
Well, that may be pushing it a little too far. And the most exciting periods are when you have competing dynasties. I think, like the Orioles and the Oakland Athletics in the early 70s. And again, the Oakland Athletics were pretty fortunate. They weren't better than the Orioles, but they beat them in 2 very close postseason series. I think interest focuses on those teams, and even on the Yankees in the 50s, or the Yankees in the late 70s, or the Yankees in the late 90s. And other teams, like the Red Sox in the late 90s or in the 70s, have to spend to try to beat them. And it makes for a higher level of play. The other thing, though, that does make for excitement, which we haven't had for 20 years now, is expansion, which increases the variance a lot between both players and teams, and thus leads usually to a series of very exciting seasons. Whereas now, again, I think that the general level of mediocrity is at probably an all-time high across baseball. It was also pretty high in the National League, in the interwar period, I'm sorry, in the pre-war period, between the 2 world wars. But now it is in both leagues.
Well, I guess what you're saying is the NFL thinks that parity is good for football, but in baseball it might not be so good?
Well, that's my personal opinion.
No.
Okay, yeah.
I might agree with it. Who knows?
Yeah, right, yeah. Okay, last question, Barley.
Yeah, I have to take partial exception to your theory. I'm familiar with one dynasty in particular, the 47 to 53 Yankees. I lived 700 yards behind Fenway Park in those years, and I didn't miss I missed one Yankee game between 47 and 53. And my mother was a huge Dodger fan, and I missed one Dodger game at Braves Field between 47 and 52. I would say that the eight starters on the Red Sox were better than the 8 starters of the Yankees during the years, say, 47, 48, 49, and 50. You had someone like Vern Stevens that most people have completely forgotten hit 137, 144, and 159 RBIs 3 years in a row. The Dodgers, likewise, were better in 50, 51, 52, 53, 50, 53 than the Yankee eight players on the field. The difference was Rashi, Reynolds, both won well over 700% as Yankees. Lopat almost won 700%. And then you throw in people like Joe Page, Tommy Burns, Spec Shea, and whatnot. And the pitching was the key thing for the Yankees that propelled them over the Dodgers and Red Sox consistently, and how anybody could say anything else is ridiculous.
In fact, no, I have to answer that. In fact, this is one of the biggest illusions in baseball. If you look at the competition between the Red Sox and the Yankees in the late 40s and also in the late 70s, because of the ballparks, the Yankee pitching is always wildly overrated. The Red Sox pitching is terribly underrated, and the reverse is true for the hitting. In the late 70s, the Red Sox pitching was far superior to the Yankees, but their hitting was inferior. That's all I'll say, but believe me, when the book comes out, it will be in black and white. Thank you very much.
Oh, could I...